Well, why don't we get started? I'm Stephen Hamburg, the Chief Scientist at EDF, and I want to really welcome you to this event and thank you for coming. Nat and I will speak for roughly 20 minutes, a little back and forth, and then really want to make this a conversation. So we'll open it up to your questions, and please don't hold back. And I will ask everyone, when you do speak, if you could say your name, just who you are, that would be greatly appreciated. And we have a few of EDF staff in the audience, so when Nat and I get stumped, we'll go to the rest of the team here. As I said, I'm Stephen Hamburg, the Chief Scientist, and I joined EDF 11 years ago. I was a professor at Brown University, and left the academy to join EDF, and I've never looked back. And it's been a great ride, and really look forward to talking about climate tonight, something that I'm passionate about and I know Nat is.
Thanks, Steve, and thanks to all of you for coming. It's great to see packed house and a number of familiar faces in the room and a number of folks I've yet to meet. As Steve said, my name is Nat Cohan. I'm the Senior Vice President for Climate, so I run the climate program at EDF. I first came to EDF right out of college, which was not a couple of years ago, unfortunately. And then after that, I was inspired to become an economist. I got a PhD. I taught at the School of Management at Yale for several years and decided I wanted to get back into policy, so I came back to EDF to work on climate legislation. In 2007, I went into the Obama administration for a couple of years in the Obama White House. And then I came back to EDF a third time because I lack any sense of originality or imagination. And I've been at EDF since 2012 and looking forward to this event.
So I'm gonna start out really painting a picture. And I'm going to even give you a punchline. Don't worry, we'll get to the good stuff later and the happy stuff. But climate change, I'd heard about it. First time I heard about it was 44 years ago when I was an undergraduate. So you can figure out your math from there. George Woodwell, who was one of the founders of EDF at the Woods Hole Woods Hole Marine Biological Lab Ecosystem Center, talking about it. It was very abstract at that point in time. It was an interesting idea. I was a student, great fun to talk about. Fast forward just a few years, I published my first paper on the impacts of climate change in 1988, and it had a very dramatic impact. Silence. It helped me get tenure because it was in Nature. So those of you who know science, that's one of the top couple journals, but really didn't get much traction. But it did for me because I recognized, which I had not seen, I was studying the forests of New Hampshire not far from here, and I started to recognize the change that was happening. And we put together a record for 150 years then to show how the forest was changing. And we had some pretty convincing data that really showed it changed dramatically over that 150 years. And in that process, I predicted how the forest would change, figuring that was something my daughter or granddaughters or somebody would see. What really got me into this business is I started seeing those impacts in those same plots that I set up in 1970s were now showing the signs of climate change. I saw it with my own eyes in the places that I had worked in that I never imagined would change to the degree that I would see it in my lifetime. It wasn't dramatic, but it was real, it was tangible, and it fit what we expected. Since then, I've worked a lot on impacts. I've worked with the IPCC, and I'm seeing those impacts everywhere. And they're real, and they're impacting people. Move forward to just last year, I paid a lot of money to change every culvert in my road. I've bought a piece of land, forest land, up in New Hampshire, and every culvert had blown out because we'd have the two biggest rains in 60 years quantitatively. We collect some of the most intense rain data about the region at Hubbard Brook. John's a board there with me on the Hubbard Brook Research Foundation, and we collect that data. We blew out every culvert. My road was impassable. That was real. I can go to the gas station and talk with the owner of the gas station, and he's never seen any. He's lived there his entire life. We're seeing things that we've never seen before, let alone we're seeing sea level rise. We're seeing impacts. There was a big front page story in the New York Times just a couple days ago. We're seeing these impacts. They're real, whether it's at the hurricane level, these storms we've seen in New Hampshire. The impacts of climate change are real, and they will get worse. That I can promise you, whether you want it or not, because we got a lot of momentum to the system. So in that sense, it's really scary. It's real. It's not even. Some places are worse than others. Already 17 years ago, I was in Mongolia, and you could watch the buildings because of the permafrost melting, tipping sideways, many of them uninhabitable. They'd been there a long time. They were not going to be there for a lot longer. So it doesn't matter where in the world you go, the signs are clear. Some are bigger, some are smaller. So that's not a very nice thing, right, to think future generations are dealing with this world, and it's changing at a faster pace. Change has always been what's been going on, but that pace is changing. And it's changing to not to our benefit. I'm going to turn it over to Nat in a minute. So that's the picture, right? It's a bit grim. And we as affluent, developing country can say, well, we can buffer it. To some degree, we can. But the most of humanity cannot. If you're a herder in Mongolia, those changes are not easily adaptable. If you get the soot come in longer, faster, you lose more of your herd. Those are all the kinds of things. But before I do that, so not leave you too negative, I'm more optimistic about dealing with climate change now than I have been in those 44 years since I first heard about it. So that's just a teaser. So despite what I just told you, I'm seeing it, it's real, and it's happening. I'm more optimistic. Over to Nat.
Thanks, Steve. Well, I want to start by talking a little bit about how we think about tackling this issue at EDF. And Steve will, and I will both talk a little bit about that, and then I'll get to provide the sort of the fun optimism at the end as well. But just in terms of how do we get our hands around this issue? Because this is a global problem. This is an issue that is the sum total of all of our actions around the world. EDF is one organization. We can't work in 195 countries. So how do we make progress and traction in a problem that's global and a problem that's so long-term? Well, we've done a couple of things to think about how to break that down. First, wherever we're going to go, the first thing we need in terms of emissions, in terms of temperature, the first thing we need to do is stop emissions rising and start having them go on a downward trajectory. We need to turn the corner on all of the carbon we're putting into the atmosphere and get it on a downward trajectory and then get it on a fast downward trajectory, ultimately towards zero. But the first thing we need to do is get to that peak. Because imagine how different the world would be if you woke up and you read that for the fifth year in a row or the second year in a row, global emissions were falling, that we were winning. So that's the first thing, is how do we turn that corner? And then how do we put in place the kinds of policies and technologies that are going to accelerate that change downward? Well, a few years ago, as part of our strategic plan, we set out to think about how we do that. How do we turn that corner? And we looked at what the world needs to do, and then we looked at that through the lens of where does EDF bring value add. And we decided to focus on where the emissions are largest, as well as where there are systematic levers that we can help influence that can make change everywhere. So where are the emissions largest? Well, the U.S. and China, the two biggest economies in the world, the two biggest emitters in the world, together about 40% of carbon emissions. So we're working in China. We've been in China for about 25 years, working to put in place national policies that will get China to turn that corner itself. The good news in China is that it's clearly on track to meet its commitment under the Paris Climate Agreement of peaking by 2030. And in fact, we think China could peak its emissions 5 years sooner, as soon as 2025. That means we'll have, the first time in history, a country that's industrialized and then started to decarbonize within the space of a couple of generations. We're also in the U.S. That's where we started and where we continue to focus. We'll talk later, I'm sure, in the Q&A about the current administration, which is trying to take us back. But in the U.S., we're still playing defense, and we can talk about that at a federal level. But we're also setting the stage for renewed federal action under a future administration, and we're making things happen in the states. And there's real bright spots that we can talk about that are happening in states, not just like California, not just like Massachusetts, but also mid-continent states like Colorado and Nevada and Minnesota. So it's not just the blue coastal states where things are happening. So China, U.S., India. India right now is the world's fourth largest emitter. Per capita, the emissions are one-tenth of the United States. But if India keeps growing and if it takes the same high-carbon growth path that the U.S. and China did, it's game over for everybody else. So we're working in India to think about how to get onto a low-carbon trajectory. And then we're looking at tropical forests. Because tropical forests, especially in the Amazon and in Indonesia, if we can reverse the deforestation that's happening there and begin to restore some of the forests that have been cut, that could account for as much of as a quarter of the solution on climate to get us to turn the corner on emissions and keep temperatures from rising too far. So the forests are an enormous opportunity, and it's one right now, because if we don't take advantage of that, if we don't protect the forest carbon in the Amazon in Indonesia, we'll have lost it. We'll have lost it forever. So those areas are four of the big areas, U.S., China, India, and tropical forests, where we think we can make progress right away, and we're seeing progress right away. The fifth one I'm going to let Steve talk about, because it's one that we've only just understood how powerful it is as a source of warming, and it's methane from oil and gas production. And I'll turn it over to Steve.
So we normally think about climate as being driven by carbon dioxide, and it is. But it actually only accounts for about half of the warming we're experiencing now. But why is that so important? Why did George Wildwell give those lectures all those years ago? Because it sticks around for a very long time. About 40% of the CO2 that you and I emitted getting here, if you did anything but walk, we emitted some. I took the train to Boston. 40% of it is in the will get taken up by oceans or the forest, and the remaining 60%, some of it will get taken up, but basically 40% of that is around for so many generations we can't count. But we have other greenhouse gases, and in particular, as Nat mentioned, methane. So methane accounts for more than one quarter. So CO2 is half. Methane is more than a quarter. Methane is much more potent than CO2 as a greenhouse gas, but it's more reactive, so it only stays in the atmosphere about 10 years. So if that 25% of the warming could be reduced significantly quickly, we'll actually bring down the rate of warming in my lifetime. So we recognized this about a decade ago, and that it wasn't getting enough attention. There was this big lever of action out there, and everyone was missing it. It acknowledged it, but said, well, the big thing is CO2. Yes. So we started talking about the and proposition. We got to deal with methane and CO2. And the largest portion of methane, the easiest to reduce, as Nat said, is from oil and gas production. It's a byproduct. It's just leakage. There's leakage out here. Boston was terrible. Why was Boston terrible? Because old pipes, early manufactured gas, not natural gas, bring in coal, convert it to gas, put it in a pipe. It was the earliest lighting in this building. So the pipes were old. The manufactured gas is actually different, higher water content than natural gas. So the oakum that's all in those pipes would leak. Well, why didn't they fix it? Massachusetts Public Utility Commission said, well, you can only replace it on a 40-year schedule. And they had to get permission from Boston to dig. they didn't want to disturb the traffic, so Boston wasn't given them permission to dig. So well, the first time I met with the senior vice president from National Grid to talk about this problem, probably 6 years ago now, maybe a little more, he said, if you can help us get the rules right so we can actually replace the pipes, that would be fabulous. And I said to him, if the leakage is as high as we think it is, at that point we didn't have good data, I said, we'll do it. And we've worked since then to do that. There's enormous opportunity. Half of the emissions from oil and gas, methane emissions from oil and gas, can be eliminated at zero net cost. We can, by 2050, lower the temperature globally by a tenth of a degree Celsius. That's a big number in this game. By simply working on oil and gas methane emissions. So we've taken on in a big way, and we think it's an enormous lever. It's now become visible. We're pulling down. A lot of other people are pulling down on it. But even more important was coming up with the data to demonstrate how important it was around the world. So we've been doing studies in the U.S. and now globally, showing how much methane emissions is present, where they're coming from, working with companies. Many of the companies, we can talk about this in the Q&A, have now taken commitments to greatly reducing their emissions. But we went one step further. We've committed to building a satellite that will measure those methane emissions around the globe, whether we can get into the country or not. I currently do not have access to Russia. Gazprom has told me many times personally, oh, of course, Steve, let's go meet in Moscow in June. We'll send you an invite. Well, you can imagine how many of those invites I've actually gotten. And I've had this conversation in international forum many times. So there's enormous capacity to slow the rate of warming while we decarbonize the economy. That's a really bright spot. And I'll just add one more bit of bright, optimistic thinking and reality, is that if we take our ability to decarbonize as it exists today, and we start thinking about the problem as how do we decarbonize, not worrying about is it 100% renewable, is it getting rid of fossil fuels, we actually are starting to see those pathways are possible equitably, reliably, and rapidly. And we're doing some work in California and nationally to define these pathways to show that we don't need to invoke a miracle to get to where we need to go. That's why I'm so optimistic. We have the tools. We may not have everything, but we can reduce carbon in our economy dramatically in ways that don't upset the economy, that actually help us address the inequality, and we can do it rapidly. To me, that's the model, that's the prescription for success. I'll turn it back to Nat.
Thanks, Steve. So I will give you three more reasons for optimism and hope that I see, and then we'll open it up to Q&A. The first one has to do with political attitudes or people's attitudes, polling, and the political results we're seeing. It's, you know, it's been for a long time, if you look at polling results around climate, if you ask people, do you believe in climate, is it an important issue, you'll see, you know, bounces around 50, 60, 70%, bounces around a little bit. But it's never high on people's lists. And that's always been the problem we've had. People, if you ask them yes, no, they care about it, but they don't make it a priority. And that is beginning to change. One poll we saw a couple months ago had the number of people who said they were alarmed by climate, you know, putting that in there, self-identifying as being in that category had doubled. It was the highest that they'd ever seen. More importantly, we did a poll of Democratic primary voters. That's obviously just a slice, but it's an important slice politically. And for the first time, Democratic primary voters in California, Iowa, New Hampshire have put climate more than any other issue in the top tier of issues for them to think about voting. So it used to be climate fell off the list after jobs and the economy and everything else. Of course, we know climate is connected to jobs and the economy and health, and people are seeing that, and we're seeing that in the political support, and that's, you're starting to see that in Capitol Hill. We're obviously a long way off from legislation in Washington, but the kind of energy you see behind the Green New Deal. We could talk about what that means, but what it, one thing it means is huge amounts of energy into this issue. You look at the Democratic primary candidates, people are talking about this issue in a way we haven't. So that's the first thing that makes me hopeful, is that politically we're seeing the support out there and we're seeing it translate into the beginnings of action. The second thing is the tailwinds we have from new technologies and technological change. Steve referred to this, but you know, in many parts of the U.S., it's now cheaper to build renewable power, not only then to build coal, but to run existing coal. So you've got Xcel Energy, which is the one of the major electricity producers in the Mid-Mountain West, eight states of a service area across the Mid-Continent, saying that they're going to reduce, they're going to decarbonize their electricity, reduce carbon by 80% by 2030 in their service area. They're doing that by themselves because it makes economic sense. In Indiana, which is the home of coal, basically, and coal-fired power, one of the Indiana's electric utilities announced last fall that it's going to shut down its coal, replace it with renewable power, and do that because that's cheaper for its customers. So this is becoming, it's making economic sense. Now, the power sector is further along than others, and we can talk about some of the challenges because the challenges are real. But we're starting to see the technologies that are going to carry us forward and get the reductions we need. And that leads me to the final source of optimism, which has more to do with policy and, not surprisingly, with economics, as I'm an economist. And it's that we know the kinds of policies that can help accelerate the transition. There's no silver bullet, but we know the kinds of policies that can make a difference. We're starting to see them already in places like Massachusetts in the Northeast, where we've got the beginnings. We have a price on carbon electricity. It's not high enough, but it's starting to ramp up. In California, we've got a cap and trade system that's putting a cap on emissions and driving it down. It's starting to bite more and more. You've got China putting a cap on or a carbon market for its emissions, moving towards a cap much far ahead of the U.S. at a national level. All of those things are part of a broader trend, which is the one thing we haven't done yet in our search for solutions is harness the incredible power of the economy and harness the entrepreneurial power and the creative power of the economy in the direction we want it to go, which is lower carbon. Right now, everything is pushing against lower carbon because all the incentives are cutting the other way. And if we can put policies in place like a price on carbon, like other policies that correct the economic incentives, we'll align everything that companies are doing, that individuals, that entrepreneurs, that innovators are doing, we'll align that with the kind of low carbon future we want to see. And when we harness that, then we'll really be able to accelerate the kind of solutions that will allow us to turn the corner and drive those emissions down towards zero. So with that, we'll end on an up note and let's go to questions.
Yeah, so hopefully we've been provocative enough to get you to engage. So questions. Don't be bashful. Yeah, and we've got some mics. So again, please remember to introduce yourself, and then, why don't you stand up and make it a little easier? Thank you.
Hi, I'm Jason Jacobs. Thank you for that. That's very exciting, especially the optimistic angle that I think we all need. But one question: when you talked about decarbonization versus 100% renewables, what does that mean for nuclear? Do we need it, and should we have it?
So I'll start, and then Nat, we both worked on that. So I would say the jury's out on nuclear in the long term. In the short term, so existing nuclear, not all of it, because there's some that are in bad shape, but produces about 20% of our current electricity. That existing power, electricity, if we were to shut it off tomorrow, you would be getting high carbon fossil replacing it for the most part. Because if you try and build your renewables fast enough to replace it, you're not building, there's no evidence you could build them fast enough to keep the current trajectory on renewables going. So you're going to end up with more fossil. So that's on existing. And obviously there are specific cases, specific plants that shouldn't keep going because of location or age or maintenance or whatever. But on average, but they're going to start, they are currently licensed almost without exception to for 60 years. There's discussion about re-relicensing. So they had 40 years, they were re-licensed to 60. There's discussion about going to 80. It's unclear that economics will work. We're in uncharted territory. So whether they'll go past 60 is really unclear. So with 60, when we get to 2035, that capacity will start declining just because the licenses will run out. And as when they need major maintenance, even before it runs out, you'll shut it down rather than invest large amounts of money. In terms of new nuclear, the way I like to view it is actually one of our trustees uses the metaphor, Steve Pakala uses the metaphor of a horse race. It's in the race. What role it'll play, where it'll place, I don't know. So do we need to keep nurturing fourth generation and other? Of course. Its currently costs are not encouraging for it to be part of the mix. It probably doesn't have to be part of the mix, but it has, because of its low carbon content, a potential role it can play. We don't have to figure that out now. We just need to not bias it one way or another as we move through maximizing our renewables and ensuring the reliability of the system and what else is going to fill whatever the gap is. In New England, that gap will be larger because of our climate. In other parts of the country, it'll be much less because you can use renewables for a much higher percentage.
I'll just be very quick. We can't take anything off the table. This will summarize Steve's. We can't take anything off the table because we're in the middle of a crisis. And we want to have policies in place that bring in whatever is going to be fastest, cheapest, most cost-effective. And so what that technology looks like, I want to put in place the policies that are going to accelerate those technologies and get them deployed as fast as possible. And if nuclear wins that horse race, then it belongs as part of that solution. But I want to focus on across the board, how do we get there as fast as we can?
So we have one here and one there.
Yeah. More on the nuclear. My name is John Seltzer. There have been a few articles in the paper lately implying that for renewables, like solar and wind, that they're not available 24/7, and that supposedly we're a long way off from having the technology to store them for off, you know, for use when those resources aren't available. So this has been one of the big arguments for nuclear because, you know, the claim is we're not going to get to those technologies soon enough. So I want to know what you folks feel about that.
So integration of renewables, you can do a lot of it with existing technology. It's going, as I mentioned, vary a little from region to region. And the more that you have interconnects between regions, so high voltage DC lines, they can be buried. So dealing with some of the siting problems cost effectively, maybe not as cheap as above ground, but not a lot more. And we saw that debate in New Hampshire with the power line there, where they proposed burying quite a bit of it. It was ultimately defeated. So is it 50% here in this region? Is it 60%? Some people would say 70. Renewables can be used. The intermittency is a very real issue, but it isn't an issue that goes with all of it because you make mixes of different sources. Existing nuclear helps you right now because we do have a 20%. So that's, if you had, let's say, just take for sake of argument, that you could put average across the country 60% renewables. You have 20% nuclear, you're now at 80. 80% decarbonization is a heck of a good deal. It's not all the way we need to go. Then you start doing things like carbon capture and sequestration. You start using negative emissions associated with some other technologies, and you start to get it pretty darn close. So the path. But you're right. The intermittency is a big deal, and that's one of the reasons why 100% renewable isn't the goal. It may be something we ultimately can do. And by combining these multiple technologies and multiple strategies in the horse race, you can make your cost much lower, you can do it quicker, and you can do it reliably. And we've tended to think of it as one technology or another. It's a portfolio, without a doubt. And then to Nat's point, how do we write the rules right so this portfolio interacts effectively? We get the infrastructure we need, these interconnects, because the wind, and this has all been modeled quite beautifully. So we know that the probability, if let's say New England is in a bad way with sun and wind, it's just, you know, have bad conditions. There's a certain probability, literally every 15 minutes for a decade have been mapped across the entire United States for every grid cell. You can say, well, if we had access to power in the Midwest, we could still be getting wind from the Midwest to cover a lot of ours. Not always, but a bunch of it.
So
you have to transport it. You have to move it around. The more that you treat each place as its own thing, the more difficult the solution is. The more you make it interconnected regionally, the more you can decarbonize more quickly, cost effectively. Yeah.
So, T. Wally Williams, Belmont, Mass. And I think there's a good chance that the Democrats will win both houses in the next, in the by-election. And if they do, one of the things that I'm proposing that people start to think about would be that they phase in a carbon tax, and instead of giving it back to people, they work on our other national problem, which is infrastructure. So you take that money as you phase it in, and you begin to put it over into infrastructure, which is really, really bad. After all, we've even had bridges collapse recently. So that's what I want to get people thinking about. Thank you.
I'll let you take that one.
I want to suggest, because I know we have a couple other folks in the room who have feelings about carbon pricing, and maybe we can pick up a couple of other questions about a carbon tax or carbon price and talk about them together.
My name's Alan Wright. I'm a local member of Citizens Climate Lobby, which is a national grassroots organization working on a carbon fee and dividend, 100% dividend program. And the reason for the dividend is that when you're doing carbon pricing, you have to think about lower income, minority, disadvantaged peoples, because they will be negatively affected by a carbon tax. You'll also have to think about Republican opposition to taxes. So one of the things that Citizens Climate Lobby is working hard on is building bipartisan support for what is the carbon energy fee and dividend program. So my question to you, gentlemen of EDF, is you were EDF was very, very involved in the early part of the Obama administration trying to get the cap and trade bill put through that Senator Markey was one of the sponsors of. Why do you suppose Senator Markey and Representative Ocasio have not, in their Green New Deal, talked about carbon pricing? What is their problem with having each individual be a regulator of their use of CO2 energy sources?
Thanks. And if anyone else wants to jump, I'll give other folks, if they have a question about carbon price or carbon tax, we can also come back to it later. So thanks for both of those questions. And I think, I'll talk a little bit about the first question around, you know, how do you think about a carbon tax? What do you use the revenue for? And then we can talk a little bit about Green New Deal, because that also incorporates this idea of infrastructure. So the place I'll start, I mentioned in the opener that one of the policies we see as really critical is some policy that puts, as we say, a limit and a price on carbon. That could be a cap and trade program like California has currently, and as the Northeast has for its electricity sector, which puts a limit on emissions that usually goes down over time and uses a market mechanism to get there. You can also set the price directly by putting a price on carbon through a tax, and that might rise over time. We've been exploring ways to kind of combine the two. So you could have a price, or you could have a carbon tax that was tied to performance. For us, the real key is you need two things out of an effective policy. One is you need to have assurance that emissions are going to fall. So one concern about a carbon tax by itself is what happens if it's just a cigarette tax and people keep smoking? Cigarette smoking has gone down, but it's not gone down all the way. How do we make sure that we really get the emissions we need, the emissions reductions we need? I'm an economist. I know all about demand elasticity, and I know all about the theory of why a carbon price will work, but I also want environmental outcomes. So we could design a carbon tax that was tied to performance, and if it wasn't getting the performance we needed, the carbon tax could rise. But whatever we do, whether it's cap and trade or a carbon tax or this kind of hybrid, the reason to use the price is to, as I said earlier, align everything so that everything in the economy is pointing towards all the incentives are pointing towards low carbon. That's going to make everything we want to do easier. Now, what do we do with the revenue? If we have a tax or if we have a cap and trade program, California auctions off the permits, you can raise a lot of government revenue. There are very smart people who say we should give that back to households, back to individuals as a dividend, which is one of the ideas that Citizens Climate Lobby has talked about. And there's a real idea why that could be popular. There's also other people who will say, as the gentleman back said, we should use it to fund infrastructure. And indeed, Carlos Curbelo, who is a Republican congressman who introduced the first Republican bill to put a price on carbon in 10 years last fall, unfortunately he lost the election, but not because of that. We have some data to show it. But Carlos Curbelo put in place a plan that was all about infrastructure. Well, from our point of view, we're focused on the environmental outcomes. And frankly, the way I want to use the revenue is the way that I'm going to get to 60 votes in the Senate and 218 votes in the House. And I think every day our political team thinks about, okay, we're the people with the policy ideas, but they're the people with the voting cards. And so I think where we're going to end up is probably a mix of these. I think it would be great to end up with a plan that gave that returned the revenue to households, because I think that's part of what's made Social Security durable. But if we're going to get to 60 votes, we may need to use some of that to address pressing problems right now, like infrastructure. The last thing I know, and if you read the New York Times Sunday Magazine last weekend, you may have seen this in there. What I will say, and what we've learned from past fights, like that fight with the Waxman-Markey bill 10 years ago, is that we don't want to lead with that mechanism. So I can tell you all about what a carbon price should look like. I can design a carbon tax, a cap and trade program, a hybrid, but that's not what I'm going to lead with. What I'm going to lead with is talking about the outcomes for people, about better health for your kids, about a safer planet, about the potential to have revenue that could go towards back to households or towards infrastructure. And I think one thing we want to make sure that we're doing is leading with all the benefits that a good climate policy will bring. Clean energy jobs, the whole the 21st century economy, and we can leave the mechanism in the background. Now, I realize I didn't get to Green New Deal. I'll come back to that if there's interest, but let's get to some more questions.
Question there, and then in the back.
My name is John Smitka, and one thing that I don't think gets enough press is demand-side management, and that's where technology can really make an impact, and it can make an impact for every person in this room to reduce their demand, to change how they live, to change how they go about moving from A to B or whatever. So I'm just wondering, why haven't we heard more about demand-side management? It's always supply-side management.
Well, no, we've seen, it probably doesn't get as much press, but there has been a big change in this country and around the world in the demand side. So the carbon intensity has dropped in absolute terms and relative to GDP. But we'll just take this building. Making this building low carbon is really tough. Our turnover of our housing stock and our building stock is really slow. So it's not easy. We're moving that way. Our building codes are better today than they were 10 years ago, than they were 30 years ago. If you live in New Hampshire, in the town that I do, John knows it, there is no building code, so I'm not told to do anything. I didn't even need a building permit when I first built my house. Didn't have to do anything. Just build it. And then I get sued if I build too close to the property line by neighbor. That's it. So you can do it. We're seeing it with the mileage standards, decreasing demand for oil. Obviously, there's an effort to roll those back. So I think it's more part of the story than you think. We're seeing it with appliance standards. We're seeing it with light bulbs. I did a lot of work with light bulbs with Walmart then when the first standards came in. And we've seen the energy used by light bulbs in America drop by roughly a factor of 4. So it's 1/4 of what it was when I started working with Lee Scott, the CEO of Walmart. I was still at Brown in 2005, though it was through EDF. I knew Fred, and Fred invited me to a meeting, and I won't get into the details. Bottom line, Walmart isn't exactly that socialist liberal institution, but saw the advantage to their customers for energy efficiency, and they pushed them. They saturated their market in 1 year. They started selling 100-plus million light bulbs a year that were energy efficient, at that point CFLs. and then we got national legislation right after it. So, again, they're trying to roll back those standards, but those standards make an enormous difference. And one of the reasons that we've seen electricity demand drop is exactly because of that, the fact that we have seen that. But there are thresholds. I have a 120-year-old house. I've done everything I can, but it isn't the easiest thing to make low energy. It's relatively low, but not absolutely low. In the back, we have somebody.
Hi. Thank you guys for what you do. My name's Bill Hopwood. If I could ask two questions, and one could be very short. What changes were you seeing in the forest, and what's the state of the art right now in carbon capture and sequestration and the economics of it?
Great. I'll take the first part and leave the second one to Nat, because that's a tough question. What we're starting to see is species shifts. Started seeing what was historically a spruce hardwood forest. I wrote my first paper on the decline of the red spruce, the fact that those, they were just gone, and it wasn't, we were able to show it wasn't because of cutting, it was because of climate. And then what we, so we saw that, I documented, and then what I saw that I didn't expect was red oak coming in. So a forest that had been spruce hardwood was becoming oak forest, and that transition was very evident. I can take you and show you all these little red oaks, and I can show you some bigger red oaks growing in these places that they're not supposed to be there. It's too cold, but they're there.
Well, I'll touch on CCS, and Steve is showing forbearance because that's also an issue close to his heart. Thanks, Bill, for the question. So carbon capture and sequestration, long mouthful of words, but it basically means how do you think about removing the carbon dioxide from a power plant or a steel mill before it gets into the atmosphere? How do you take it out of the flue gases and sequester it, store it underground, so that it can't come out? So that's something we've been doing with pollutants like sulfur dioxide and nitrous oxides for decades. It's part of how we solved acid rain, which if you nudge me, I'll tell you the story. It's much harder to do with carbon, but it's technically feasible. And so Bill's question is a good one about the economic feasibility and economic cost. The state of the art right now, and you probably know more about this than I do, is a facility in Texas. What it's really interesting about that facility is using natural gas. So 10 years ago, and this shows you how fast the technology is changing, aided by some of the policies we put in place when I was in the Obama administration, but how fast the technology is changing. 10 years ago, everybody was talking about carbon capture and sequestration was going to be on coal because we had so many coal plants. What are we going to do with them? That may still be true for China, which has built a big chunk of coal plants. Hopefully we can prevent that huge wave of coal plants from coming elsewhere. For the U.S., we're retiring our coal plants. Last year, U.S. coal consumption hit a 39-year low. So we're going in the right direction. That there's still more to be done. But what that means is now people are thinking, okay, we're going to need to take that capture technology and put it on natural gas plants. Because the flip side is we realize while natural gas is cleaner than coal, at least in terms of the carbon it puts into the air, it still is emitting carbon. And we need to get to zero. And you can't get to zero if you're still burning fossil fuels. So we need that technology on natural gas. There's a very promising power plant that's still in the kind of pilot stage. You may know more about the details, but it's looking good so far. And if that shows promise, then that will be a potential game changer. The last thing I'll say, though, is it's just like the question on nuclear. We need to have everything on the table. Let's put the technology-neutral policies in place that let's pit natural gas CCS against renewables, against demand-side management, against nuclear, and let's let the best zero-carbon technology that's the cheapest and the most reliable and the most affordable and the quickest to get the emissions down, let's let that portfolio win.
And I'll just add to that. So when we put them against each other, that first 10%, as Nat said, will be renewables at this point. That's your cheapest option. What's your 50, your middle decile, and what's your last decile? And the point is your answer will probably differ at this point in time. Because if you want to use renewable for your last 10%, it's so inefficient in terms of storage and redundancy to get the reliability, you're going to be, your CCS will be more cost effective. So the plant that Nat was talking about is Net Power, not only does it use it with gas, it produces through that technology a pure stream of CO2. One of the biggest costs of doing CCS is concentrating that CO2. Well, you're starting with a concentrated. you can put it underground in old oil and gas caverns. That's what they currently do for enhanced oil recovery. That technology is pretty well developed. And the question is, what's the cost price? And is there's a price on carbon, all of a sudden that becomes quite viable. It hasn't caught on because it's an added cost right now. There's no economic incentive to do it.
Hi, Carolyn Britt from Ipswich. Just wondering, you've been talking a lot about all the solutions. I earlier today spent a couple hours with the Extinction Rebellion, and we hung out downtown. We walked over to the Globe. The basic theory of the Extinction Rebellion being that the media just isn't covering this in any way, shape, or form that it needs. And I'm wondering what your opinion is on that. And they even came up with this nice headline that, you know, you'd love to see in the Globe about finally admitting that the climate crisis is real. And I have started to read the New York Times piece from last weekend. It looks pretty good. But I haven't seen anything from the Globe. And, in fact, they have had some very, I thought, detrimental editorial pieces. So just your thoughts about, you know, is the media as essential as it seems in both pulling together the people who actually have the voting cards and putting pressure on the, you know, both ends? Thanks.
I'll just deal with the extinction issue and then turn the politics back over to Nat. So obviously extinctions and the impacts of climate change is real, and it's what got me into it. I'm an ecologist. We're seeing coral reefs really devastated. That's where my pessimism is larger because the momentum is quite great in those systems. The one bit of optimism there is the adaptation, and others evolution. There's some evidence that these systems actually can evolve, the organisms, so that we may be able to both naturally and through assistance help them evolve to be more temperature tolerant, so that these coral systems. But don't forget there are multiple drivers. So absolutely climate's important, but so is land use change. So are exotics. So we're seeing a lot of amphibians are under attack because of fungi that are attacking them. While climate is part of it, it's not all of it, because we do not control the importation of pests very effectively. We're seeing enormous, right? We would have been sitting 100 years ago under, I don't know, but I'll bet a lot of money this was a row of elms right here. All right, and then we are now seeing the woolly adelgid has gone through Boston, so you don't see that many hemlocks. And the emerald ash borer will be here shortly. It's not here. It's up in Concord. I don't know where it is in Mass at the moment, but it will be here, and you'll lose all your ash trees. Those are all exotic pests. So we have invasives, we have land use change, and climate change, and there's lots of synergy between them. So that part is pretty grim. There are some things we can do to make these systems more resilient, and we actually have it at EDF. Our ecosystems program is working a lot on how do we build that resilience, recognizing that we can't fully reverse or control some of these variables.
I'll just briefly comment on the media piece. I think actually the media is it's a mixed bag, but it's getting a lot better. I credit the New York Times greatly for really expanding its coverage of climate. 10 years ago, when we were fighting for legislation in the Congress, it would always be the this and the other hand, right? Well, yeah, you know, climate scientists say that the globe is warming, but there's a handful of people, kooks funded by the oil industry, who say that it's not. You know, I'm a journalist; it's going to be even-handed. That has ended. And the New York Times, to its credit, Andy Revkin was one of the earliest journalists who was doing this for a long, long time. The Times now has a stable of people. I really encourage you. I don't mean to be, you know, pumping for the Times, but they have a stable of people working on this. They have things online. I don't know about the Globe as well. I know that the Post is doing pretty well. I also know that online, Vox.com does a lot of good stuff. Bloomberg does some good reporting. So we're seeing more and more of that in print and online media. I think the laggard is broadcast television, and where it's been much harder. And so there's some great people. There's a group called Climate Central, based out of Princeton, that does a lot of work to provide content, especially to local media markets. There's a group called Climate Nexus. There's a group called Climate Nexus, which does a lot of work on media to improve media sophistication. So I think it's improving. But frankly, I would say the best way to get the media to improve is to have them hear from readers and from viewers. And so I'm really glad that you're out there making your voices heard, because that's what's going to change the media here.
I just add one more thing on the media, which is you need to help your local, not just the bigger newspapers and media, but a lot of people see the local, whatever it is, you know, your little local rag, or website or whatever, and tell the stories about climate change. So we did an exhibit that was traveling around that's now at the Boston Museum of Science that I did about a little over a decade ago that told the story of climate impacts on individuals. Lobster fishermen talked about maple syrup production in New Hampshire, and we showed how this was totally changing their lives and their ability to produce. We talked about these intense rainstorms that I'm experiencing, you know, that I had to replace my culverts. So if you can get the local media to pick up these real stories about real impacts, at least my experience is that that really changes people's views. You can go to conservative backcountry New England, and they get that story. We did put a sharper point on it. We did a meeting about 12 years ago in New Hampshire on the impacts of climate change on forestry. Not forests, forestry. So cutting, we had loggers. Because we'd had two bad winters where they had to shut down in February, we got oversubscribed. We had 350 people in Concord, New Hampshire. And the Manchester Union leader wrote a positive story about how this was a real crisis for the forestry industry in the state of New Hampshire, and we really needed to worry about this. One here and then back there. We'll try and go back and forth and front and back.
Hi, I'm John Eyre. I live in the Fenway. I know it's a world problem. Do you have any knowledge of how people are reacting in Southeast Asia and Africa? And because we're to blame in the industrial world. How could we stop them from wanting to improve their infrastructure? And what do you know anything about how they're thinking about this?
I'll speak to that a little bit, actually, from India, which is an area we've been working in with partners for about a decade. I've spent more time in Delhi than I have in Boston in the past couple of years because we're setting up an office there to have more of a presence. I'll tell you that there's two sides to the story. So you talk to people in India, policymakers, or to people. I'm not talking to people on the street, but I'm talking to as many people as I can in different think tanks and NGOs and so on, as well as policymakers at the international and the domestic level. The number one priority for India is economic development and is poverty alleviation in the rural sector in particular. They've got 700 million people living in the rural areas or more, I guess, and they've got a couple hundred million of those people who don't have electricity. So they've got to be focused on that. So our challenge is, how do we demonstrate that there's a low-carbon path to prosperity? Because, by the way, there is no high-carbon path to prosperity, right? The high-carbon path leads to wrecking the planet. That's where we're headed now. So how do we do that? How do we show the Indian policymakers at the state level, at the federal level, households in the village, that there's a path that improves their quality of life that's also low carbon. We've been doing that in rural areas with a range of partners to show the things like agricultural techniques that improve yields, that improve their profitability, that improve resilience, and that reduce emissions. Cleaner cook stoves that reduce indoor air pollution, that improve diet, that improve their lives, that women doesn't have to spend 5 hours gathering fuel wood, and reduces emissions. Now, the big challenge there is scale. India is a big place. We've reached about 300,000 households. That is a drop in the bucket in a place with 170 million households in the rural area. So we're working with the state governments and the national government to scale that up into the millions. That's the vision we've got. But the point is, we're not going to get there by saying, well, you can't develop, I'm sorry, because we've used up all the carbon. We've got to show a low-carbon pathway. But if we can do that, then we can succeed. And, you know, I've talked about kind of village-level interventions, but you look at solar power, you look at wind power, that's becoming cheaper than coal. in many areas. You do have that intermittency issue that Steve talked about. The sun doesn't blow, shine all the time. The wind doesn't blow. So we need to address those issues. But the economics are helping. We just need a path that shows the route to development in a low-carbon way, and those countries will take it. I focus on India because that's where we've been, but another reason to focus on India is because we've also worked in China for 25 years, but India has the potential to be a model for other countries in a way that, you know, countries in Southeast Asia and Africa, they look at China and they say, well, that's China. But India is a chaotic, vital, thriving democracy. If you can do it in India, then okay, now there's something that you can have a model that might work in other places.
And what Nat didn't say is, and one of the vehicles for doing that is through air pollution. Mm-hmm. If you've ever spent any time in India, you know about air pollution. It's a mass killer in India. And of course, much of the air pollution comes from combustion of material. So it leads to greenhouse gases. And we are seeing there China leading. Politically, it's such a hot topic in China. That is a driver for every politician has to meet air quality goals. And I've been into the major coal regions of China with senior leadership, and they're talking about how can we reduce the air pollution, and they get it that it has to be part of reducing coal. And then what are the substitutes? So even in a place, it's not getting to climate through climate, it's getting through climate through air, because they got to deal with it because it's politically untenable, even in China, to continue the status quo. They recognize they will lose control. The Communist Party will lose control. So everywhere it's reported, everybody has it on their phone. We're working with entrepreneurs to develop new technology in China and apply it. So allow us to map at ever finer scales and pick out individual pollutant sources, even if they're not registered with the government. And we've been working with the GIVIT, and the industry, the government is super excited about this because we've been doing some pioneering work there to give them the power to sort of crack down on individuals. And that all gets back to climate, because now all of a sudden you don't have that coal. If you go to Beijing, it's illegal to burn coal in your house. On a cold night, you don't need anything more than your nose to know that isn't working. So they need the tools to be able to, for people to know we really will enforce it, because otherwise the emissions are much higher, greenhouse gas emissions, than they would otherwise. And they're doing it. So it's real. We had one over.
My name is Tom Redburn. So it sounds like most people in this room agree, as I do, with the intellectual argument for a carbon price, carbon tax. But the politics of that are very difficult. Canada, the Tory party there, the Conservative Party, is going to run against a carbon tax. Australia has already repealed it. Obviously, the Republicans totally oppose the idea. So my question is, can you imagine an effective climate policy without some sort of carbon price?
It's a good test for an economist.
I was going to say, we may give different answers on
this. I can imagine getting started. And there are certainly policies we could put in place that would get our emissions down without a carbon price. Can we get the level of ambition and the scale and the pace we need without fixing those kind of economic incentives the way a carbon price would? You know, we could probably jerry-rig something if we were willing to do enough subsidies, and if we, you know, jerry-rigged an economic incentive policy, let's say in the electric power sector through a clean energy standard, and then try to get a little bit of way there through emission standards, you know, sector by sector you can go through. We could certainly put policies in place that will start emissions reducing, and if that's what we have to do, that's what we have to do. The value of the carbon price is simply that it accelerates everything, or that it allows for everything to be accelerated because of those economic incentives without the high cost of the subsidies. So I think the politics, from my point of view, if that's where we need to end up, then we'll do, you know, we got to find the ways that work, but we also have to find ways to make the politics work. And we've been able to do that in places like California. I know California seems like, you know, California is far away from Washington in many respects. But one lesson from California is that if you can build agreement around the need for action, and you do that first, that's one political coalition that's going to be behind that. And then you can get a different political coalition, which also can get you to majority, behind doing that in a cost-effective way through a carbon price. So in California, the way they recently, we were a core part of this, they recently extended the cap and trade program they have. They extended it through 2030. How did they do that? Because there was also opposition in California to that. Well, first, Governor Brown said, I'm setting a much more ambitious policy for 2030, 40% reduction from 2020. So California has a 2020 target that was get back to 1990. Governor Brown said, executive order, 40% below by 2030. An executive order is not law, so then he went to the legislature and he said, we're going to pass a law, put that into California law, 40% below. We're not going to say how to do it. You got to meet that target. That was able to get a coalition of folks to pass that law. Then he came back in 2017. He needed a supermajority in California because of their laws to get a extension of cap and trade. But he was able to get that because once you have that kind of ambitious target on the books, then there's a whole lot of people who are interested in making that as cost-effective as possible and getting there as easily and as cheaply as possible. So that's part of the politics that I would say is if we can build that strong coalition for action, it's hard to do both things at once, but that's going to be part of the political answer.
And just to add to what Dan said, so in California, there was AB 617 that went along with it that was part of the deal, which was really about addressing air quality issues in communities of lower income. Because there was a concern that in the cap and trade that there'd be winners and losers. So they just passed it. That was part of the political compromise. Say, okay, we're going to pass an ability to address air quality independent of that to ensure that from an air quality standpoint, there weren't going to be winners and losers. And so we've been working in Oakland where we had been working on this air quality work, developing this new science. So we had already developed the data. So that's now the farthest along in that community, working with the environmental justice community to develop policies that will reduce pollution and improve air quality in low-income neighborhoods using the funding that came out of this bill that was part of the compromise, into recognizing this a win-win. Because we all want to have better air, and we all want to have a better climate. So let's address that need at the same time, and that build the political momentum to get the thing across the finish line, because you'd say, yes, we're not trading this off. We're going to do both. It's not a trade. There was a question back there.
Yeah, Debbie Cook from Cohasset. And I was wondering, you had mentioned that the tropical rainforests, mm-hmm. especially around the Amazon, are so critical, mm-hmm. you know, to our survival. And Bolsonaro in Brazil is such a scary figure. And I was wondering what kind of collaborative effort or mobilization or how you were going to handle what kind of efforts were going on to counterbalance him.
It's a great question. For those of you who haven't heard of this, Bolsonaro's Brazilian president elected last year, who's a right-wing, kind of the Brazil's answer to Donald Trump, if you will, but it also has a record of railing against indigenous rights and indigenous territories, which are core to forest protection, and is very friendly with the sort of the worst parts of the agribusiness industry in Brazil, which has been a source of deforestation for a long time. So, you know, the headline is that Bolsonaro is an enormous threat. And so the first line is, and it's much like, I'll tell you, the story unfolds much as it does in the U.S. over the past couple years. So the first thing is defense. In Brazil and the Amazon, we work largely through partners. We don't have an office of our own, but instead we helped to found two of the country's most effective and largest environmental groups. And we still work very, very, very closely with them as well as a number of other partners. So we sort of operate this bridge role. They're working on the ground in Brazil. We can help bridge them to international negotiations, to international forums. We can provide analysis. We can provide support and so on. So the first line of defense is in those indigenous territories, so indigenous territories and protected areas together in the Amazon account for about half of the forest area and a little bit more of the forest carbon. And indigenous territories alone count for about half of that. So a quarter of the forest carbon in the Amazon is protected by indigenous peoples, and so our partners are working with them to defend their borders, to defend their rights, and that's a critical part of the work. But at the same time, we're working to go beyond that, to put in place the kind of positive economic incentives that, again, like a carbon price, will change will change all of those incentives and make forests worth more standing than dead. That's the key, right? If we can put positive economic incentives in place that reward that forest carbon, then we don't have to rely just on enforcement. We can also rely on self-interest and economics. That's tough to do in the era of Bolsonaro, but like the U.S., Brazil is a federal country. It has a federal system. So even as we're working to protect indigenous rights against the federal government, we can work with some of the states. Mato Grosso, which is one of the biggest agricultural producers in the world, one of the major producers of beef and soy in Brazil, has a program in place with lots of support from governments like Germany's in the UK and support from us and other NGOs, has a program in place to reduce deforestation while increasing agricultural output, and to do that in part through some of these positive economic incentives. We're working to link up forest protection in places like Mato Grosso and the state of Acre in Brazil with carbon markets in places like California. So there are things we can do, even with Bolsonaro in power, to try to create some of those economic incentives and create positive pressure to preserve the forest. We'll come back to you.
Hi. My name is Harry Mishkin, and my question comes from my recent, over the last year, involvement with the town of Andover in Northern Mass, trying to get them to adapt the municipal aggregation model that was developed by the state to allow municipalities to aggregate electrical sources for their citizens that would include a higher percentage of renewable energy. In this aspect, I'm coming up with the need that you've touched upon, but kind of like the other side of the positive economic models of moving away from fossil fuel is to get people to consider the costs of doing nothing. And I realize this is in the realm of probabilities, you know, greater weather consequences and so on and so forth, but if you have kind of like a summary fact sheet to get folks to start to consider, okay, here, you know, you're looking at the bottom line of aggregating renewable energy sources and it's starting to get competitive, but factor this in. If you do nothing, what are the potential costs?
So let me give a quick answer on that, because I think that's a critical part of the issue. We often talk, or people want to, you know, what are the costs of renewables, what are the costs of this? And the economics are getting much, much better. And so the story is all good on that side. And, as you say, we need to remember that the cost of inaction is much greater. So how do you measure that? This is something that economists like to think about. But I'll tell you that there's a number you can look at, which is called the social cost of carbon. And it's one of the things that the Obama administration put into place that's been rolled back by the Trump administration, but all of the intellectual work is done and it could be reinstated. And the idea behind that is to say, we're going to look at all the damages that we can estimate from future carbon emissions and express them as a dollar per ton. So you might say, well, what's the cost of a ton of carbon? Well, it depends on a bunch of assumptions you make about the discount rate, but basically the answer is right now the cost of a ton of carbon is about $47. That's a low estimate, actually. I would probably pick a discount rate that would put up at 60 or 70 or 80. But the point is that the Obama administration did this to put into practice so that every regulatory analysis that got done had to take into account the benefits of reducing carbon emissions or the cost of increasing carbon emissions. And that's the kind of metric that you want to be including into decision-making, whether it's in towns, whether it's in electric utility decision-making. We were involved. I was involved back in 2010. I mentioned the Xcel Energy, the Colorado utility that is decarbonizing its power system. Well, back in 2010, I was an expert witness for one of the first cases where a public utility commission was considering incorporating this social cost of carbon into rate planning. Right, so you're an electric utility, regulated utility. You have to come before the Public Utility Commission to justify what kind of combination of electric power generation you're going to use. Well, you ought to be including the cost of society of emitting carbon into the air, and that 2010 case was the first time one of the first times that had been done. So there's lots of ways to use that metric. And if you want one fact sheet or you want one number, that's the one to use.
So just two quick things on that. So one is, Nat put it that the Obama administration did this, but there's a much larger literature on this. So the National Academy of Sciences did a big report to vet it. So it wasn't, so it, you don't have to treat this as a political thing. There's a great literature that's not partisan about the values and how they're determined. And the second thing I'd say for your particular case, is to look at the town or the towns and what infrastructure is vulnerable and what the costs are if you have to address that. We saw that with Irene in Vermont. We've seen it with these storms in New Hampshire. I'm sure there are comparable things here in Massachusetts where these towns, most of them are small, have borne enormous costs for infrastructure for storms that we can document are outside. And now because of the science of attribution, we can even say the probability was increased because of climate change. We can't say the storm was from climate change, but it was, you know, we 50% higher probability that it happens, and we're going to see more of them. So those kinds of data are available, and you can show in local towns your their vulnerability. You see that in your sewer systems if you have them. You see that in your roads and your culverts, and there are a whole source of ways. And you just say, look, we can do our part to try and reduce those, or we can just accept those costs. We had a question there. Yes, please.
Hi. My name's Liza Connolly. I was interested to hear the update on methane, so thank you for that, and also the question about Brazil and agriculture. So I'm going to try to tie these two together. Do you have any updates or info on sharing how to reduce methane in the United States, in particular with our own big agriculture businesses, and in particular the factory farms? And part two of that is, do you see any benefit or shift in the methane output with sort of the trend more towards veganism and vegetarianism as actually helping in global warming?
Great. Thanks. So great question. So agriculture is an important source of methane. And in the U.S., the role of large-scale feedlots is a mixed one. So I'm going to take this apart and say something that will not be popular with many people. If you eat a pound of beef from a industrial cattle system versus a pasture-fed, the data suggests you will put less greenhouse gases from the industrial than from the pasture-fed. Why is that? That's because it takes longer for that cow on the pasture to put that pound of beef on its side before it goes to slaughter. But it's in, and the quality of the grass is actually such that it produces more methane than if it's being fed this diet with corn and other things. Now, there are other reasons why you may not want to buy that beef from the industrial farm. I get that. But then what you can do on the industrial farm is two things, which is now happening, is you can, there are supplements that are coming online for the feed that the most promising right now, which is very far along, it's not yet approved, will reduce methane by 30%. It's a small addition. All the tests that I've seen, and I've been following it reasonably, I don't know the very latest data, shows it has no measurable impact on, basically what it does is, it, the gut of the cow, you need to just shift, just like with us, the microbiome, and you shift it just slightly. And there's no inherent reason why the ones, the critters that produce the methane need to be there for the cow to live. So you just have to shift that. And you can add these additives to try and shift that microbiome. So you can get, reduce their methane is one thing you can do. There is some very promising but early indications actually using algae, but it's very early. But the early data suggests it could even be more, much larger reductions in methane if that bears out. But that's still early. Don't know if that'll work. And the second thing is when you have concentrated animals with waste, you can reduce the methane and you can produce biogas if it's handled correctly. And there's increasing pressure to do that. And some of the largest firms are actually engaging now in commitments to do that, both from a smell and for a whole host of reasons. And so there'll be an advantage there. So you won't be producing as much. So those are potential upsides. There's a whole host of other reasons. With respect to the issue of not eating meat, absolutely. As individuals, if you want to reduce the impact of your diet on the climate, The less meat you eat, absolutely, the less dairy, you will have a lower impact. That's not always possible for everybody. It's obviously a choice. I'm not aware of any quantitative data to say that changes in the diet in the U.S. because of, but I just don't. There may be data. I'm not aware of it that says that, in fact, that's had a substantive impact. Yeah, over here.
Hello. Whoops. My name is Carrie Butfield, and some 25 years ago, I was the chair of the grassroots organization that helped bring curbside recycling to Boston, thanks to the late, great Tom Menino, and been trying to fight the good fight ever since. I'm on Natick Sustainability Committee. We're working to move to net carbon emissions in different fronts. We as a people have really screwed things up here on the planet, and I'm hopeful that AOC and our own Senator Markey is going to, with the New Green Deal, is going to help things. I'm sure the folks on the other side of the aisle are going to say, oh, these crazy wackos, you know, how are we going to pay for this, so on and so forth. It does give me hope that, you know, that's going to be the solution for the next generation. What are your thoughts on what could derail that and how it's going to continue to move forward?
Well, thanks. And, I, you know, first of all, I think the energy and the injection of enthusiasm and youthfulness into the debate. I don't just mean Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I mean the Sunrise Movement. We're seeing youth getting into this and totally transforming the climate discussion in Washington. That's an amazing development. And, you know, I wake up every day when I'm, well, every day that I wake up thinking about the U.S. when I'm not thinking about China and India, every day I wake up thinking about the U.S., I'm thinking about how do we get to 60 and how do we get to 218. And I am less pessimistic about, you know, the other side of the aisle, as you said. I have no illusions about Senator McConnell and the leadership of the Republican Party, but I see people. I mentioned Carlos Curbelo before. You know, Carlos, again, he lost his reelection, unfortunately, and maybe mainly lost it because he was in a district that was plus 20 or something for Clinton. But the reason that he came around, which connects to a lot of the things we've been talking about, he was a congressman from Miami, and he saw in his district every day the effects of climate change. You know, in Miami, I haven't been down there in a while, but they've got sunny day flooding. You want to see what climate change looks like? You want to see what sea level looks like? You got to pump your streets in Miami even on sunny days because of the rising sea levels. And so that's something that changed his mind. But it's not just Curbelo. You're seeing Brian Fitzpatrick is a Republican from Pennsylvania, another young congressman who also sees this as a critical issue for him to solve. So I don't want to be Pollyannish. I mean, I think right now, you know, I've kind of run through not my whole list, but two of the more prominent ones: Francis Rooney from Florida, although he's not quite as young. But there's some others out there. It's a small number, but it's a growing number. And the reason that I think that's important is because if we're going to get to 60 and 218 votes in the House and 60 votes in the Senate, we're going to need people from both sides of the aisle. And if we're going to have a durable policy that lasts, which is going to be really critical, everything we're talking about in terms of solutions needs investment. It needs people. If we have a price on carbon, people need to believe that it's going to be there beyond the next turn of the administration, so they make investments that cut carbon and that respond to innovation. So the only way to get there is going to be, I think, a way that brings in some bipartisanship. Okay, so then that gets back to Green New Deal. I would love to see Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, you know, and her and the Sunrise Movement behind her, leverage that enthusiasm and look for what's the bridge to the folks like Carlos Curbelo and Brian Fitzpatrick. I haven't seen it yet. We're thinking about what is the bridge. If they don't do it, what is the bridge that can give us, that can draw on that support we're seeing on the left of the Democratic Party, but also draw on the support of people who are starting in the Republican Party to see this as an issue that they need to deal with. I'll just give you one example. One of the frames we're thinking about is just talking about this in terms of 100% clean. We need to get to 100% clean energy across the economy in the U.S. by 2050. Now, we would define that as net zero emissions by 2050, not just the electric power sector, but all across. How do we do that? We can talk about policy solutions, but we can talk about a price on carbon, but let's start with where we need to get to. And I think when we've started to talk with folks about 100% clean, that seems to be something where it might have the potential to draw folks from all across, or at least the side of the political spectrum that wants to talk about climate. So I want to I want to capitalize on that momentum. I think there's a lot of good ideas in the Green New Deal, but I want to focus on how we get to a durable policy with broad political support that's going to last.
In the back.
Hello, my name is Ann Levy, and I live in Boston, but I was born in Indiana. I noticed earlier that you emphasized the name of that state for obvious reasons, although when I was growing up, it was a very liberal state in terms of senators. A lot of what you've just been saying feeds into what I want to bring up. When I look around me here, I can't help but see that you're preaching to the choir. We're a very homogeneous group here in terms of color and age and education and everything. Got to start somewhere. But how does EDF play into non-political educational goals? How can we reach out to children and public schools in a way that is not knee-jerk? We have to talk about climate change because that will never work in certain Republican states. But how can EDF help science curricula, awareness of climate among young people? Because our generation has not done such a great job.
Gwen, can I call on you to talk about moms?
Hi, I'm Gwen Ruta. I work for Environmental Defense Fund out of the Boston office, so I'm thrilled to see such a big thing. John Seltzer, who I knew from 30 years ago, I'm like, I gotta go say hi. Steve was talking about something that EDF started 5 years ago, eight years ago, called Moms Clean Air Force. There's actually a parallel organization in Massachusetts called Moms Rising. Mothers Out Front. So if you're here, you don't really have Moms Clean Air Force as an option, but Mothers Out Front is just as good. But that is a situation where we're working with not just moms, also dads and kids, and really helping them to get active on climate change. And so part of it is about education. It's more like activism education, though. I think that's the sweet spot for EDF as opposed to, say, curriculum or something like that. It's about how do we get people to actually want to do something and get their elected officials to want to do something and be active in their towns and do the kinds of things that all you people are clearly doing, which is fantastic. So that's one thing. We also have another program that's called Defend Our Future, which is specifically geared towards college students and getting college students active, working through their most colleges have like a college climate club type thing, so working through that. So we have a number of different outlets, but I would say that the focus that we've taken is around sort of activism education. We're training people to become climate activists.
I was just going to add one thing. So, and it's about 1 million members strong, moms, right?
Moms, yes. Mm-hmm.
So I was just going to say briefly, that's a part of that. Moms is the most prominent part of one thing we took away from the climate legislative fight we did about 10 years ago, which gets to your question at the heart of it, which is it's not, you know, EDF, we've always known that EDF can't do this alone, but even the big green groups can't do it alone. And so we went out deliberately to say, okay, we need to build much broader support from a number of groups that aren't necessarily represented in the EDF, in EDF or the green groups. Now, moms, of course, there's overlap. There are a lot of moms represented in EDF, but we work with a group called Green Latinos and the Latino Voter Project and many other groups that are looking to raise awareness among Latinos. We reach out to environmental justice groups that are looking in low-income communities. We've helped to seed evangelical environmental groups that are creating evangelical voices in that community, sometimes in a very fairly conservative Republican communities about, and you know, what resonates with them is the values of stewardship and values of protection. That doesn't necessarily have EDF, in many cases that does not have EDF fingerprints on it. And it's not that it's EDF driven, it's that we're looking to nurture and support and seed all of those voices, because if we're going to succeed, it's got to be not just EDF, not just the green groups, but it's got to be a much broader array of voices who are in the fight.
The military is another big constituency, national security.
Question here. It's just time for two more, I'm afraid.
Hi, thank you so much. And kudos to EDF, kudos to EDF for being one of your hallmarks is working with corporations, with the entrenched interest groups. So my question to you is, are you doing any work, have you thought about working with the utilities, the gas utilities in particular, to re-envision themselves, recreate themselves, change the regulation and the legislation that would allow them to do it so that they would have life after we've gotten off of methane? You mentioned Xcel. We know about Green Mountain. But we have Eversource. We have National Grid. We have Columbia Gas, who have dug in and have bought off all the powers that be here. So if you can move them along, that would be great.
So I'll start. I'm not sure I'm going to have a totally satisfying answer to that. But one of the things that I've had the opportunity, something I never would have expected, is to work with a lot of the oil and gas companies, and not directly the utilities, but the oil and gas companies which are underlying those utilities, for the last few years, including very early in something called the Oil and Gas Climate Initiative, which was originally 10 of the world's largest companies producing one quarter of the oil and gas, is now 13, producing over 30% of global production, and in joint ventures we're talking about half of global production. And sitting in a room with almost just them and a few of non-members of the oil and gas, and they recognize that their future is nothing like the present. And so you can make common cause with them that coal is not good. They get that. It's in their self-interest, and that oil is not going to be a long-term winner. So then that leaves you with gas, and we can disagree on what the slope of the decline is, but make common cause that we got to get rid of the methane and that it's a downward slope. So I think that I've seen, which I never would have expected, that the C-suite folks get that their industry in the leading company, international companies, is changing and changing quickly, and they've got to adapt. And that's why so many of those companies, almost all of them, have committed to reducing their methane emissions to levels we would have never expected them to commit to. And that's why we're putting up a satellite, because we can hold their feet to the fire, because now we'll be able to measure it and say you are or aren't doing it. But completely agree, you've got to figure out what the future, but you know, we can argue about that last few percent, but let's get there and then have that argument would be what I'd say. But many of them get it, that they're not going to be selling the same stuff they're selling now. Some don't, but many, many do, has been my experience. I mean, things that you don't hear in public that I hear them say in private. They might deny that I've heard them say it, but they've said it. All right, we have one more question here, and then we're going to run out of time.
Roger Rosen from Arlington. You talked about the Amazon. Can you give us an update on the palm oil industry and the Indonesian rainforest?
Sure. I'll be relatively brief because we've focused less on that area just because we don't have the same kind of contacts and deep contacts. So there are groups like WRI, World Resource Institute, Nature Conservancy, Conservation International that do great work in Indonesia, and we'll have more focus on that. What I'll say is one of the things we've seen, it's been a very interesting some lessons learned about the power of working with corporations, as well as some of how we have to incorporate new lessons and think about how to align the work we do with corporations with policies. And I'll tell you what I mean. And I was having this discussion earlier with someone here. A couple of years ago, so the issue, if you don't know, that Indonesia, one of the major sources of emissions from deforestation, and in fact not just deforestation but from peat burning, is in Indonesia. There's been massive amounts of clearing of forest, draining of the peat wetlands, and then that holds huge amounts of carbon which can go up in smoke, literally. And a lot of that is driven by palm oil production and palm oil plantations. So a couple of years ago, you know, one of the ways that people have been trying to address that has been by getting companies to make commitments to buy palm oil that's being produced from suppliers that say we're going to be making sure that we're not cutting down the forest. And a couple of years ago, there were huge fires in Indonesia, and if you looked, what you'd see is that there were the parts of the peat that weren't burning were often the parts that were from suppliers who had made these commitments. And so there were two ways to look at that. One way was, the supply chain commitments are working because the suppliers who have made pledges, you know, their places aren't burning. But that was just a fraction of the overall area. And the other way to look at it was, we still have a lot of the Indonesian peatland burning. So what do we do more to leverage those commitments? And so this is an answer that I think will work in Indonesia, and we're also using it in places like Mato Grosso in Brazil that I mentioned before. How do we align those corporate commitments when a Walmart says we're going to make sure that our soy or our palm oil is deforestation free? How do we align those corporate commitments with the kind of scale we need to make a difference at a landscape scale across an entire country or entire jurisdiction? And the way to do that is to align those corporate commitments with policies that the governments are putting in place. And that's a discussion that's starting to happen in Brazil. It's starting to happen in Indonesia. But in other words, we need to make those corporate commitments and the policies aligned with each other and reinforcing each other rather than thinking of them as separate levers. So to close the loop on palm oil, one of our concerns that we are tracking is that palm oil is now being grown in more and more in Brazil. And so we need to track that as well. And the reason it's growing it sometimes is perverse incentives to use biofuels. And so we need to correct the policies in place where that's happening, and we need to correct the incentives on the ground. That's the way we'll make progress.
So I want to thank everyone here for not only coming, but your support of EDF. I know we did not get to all the questions, so what we will offer, if you write it down, your question, if we didn't get to it, and leave it at the desk on your way out, we promise we'll get back to you with an answer. So do leave the questions. I apologize, but it's great to see that enthusiasm, your commitment. This is a problem that we cannot solve singly. We can only do it collectively, and really appreciate your own individual commitments to the work that you collectively do and your support of EDF. And thank you very much for coming.